And I did think last week that there would be a sufficient continuity that we could sort of follow through from the beginning to our own time. This week, I'm going to take a separate topic each day and then try to organize what I have to say around it. This is the outline I've made. It's subject to change without notice. But today I'm going to speak about Mao and his thoughts. And tomorrow I'd like to take a couple of contemporary accounts, lest you think that the things I say may be one-sided. I have three or four recent accounts by journalists who've been in China and who have written up what they've seen. Today, 1973, and I'm sure that'll occupy our time tomorrow. Number three, I'd like to speak on the religions in China in more detail, Confucius and Buddhism, Taoism. Fourth, relationship of China and the West. And then five, the place of Christian missions in China, which I think will look a little different after you've seen these things that go before. Most Lutherans and Christians are interested in missions, and they ask, what about the missionary chapter in Japan, in China? Well, you won't understand what happened to the missionaries, nor what the problems of the future are, unless you've seen it against this larger background that I hope we can sort of paint this week. Today I want to speak then about Mao and his Red Book, which I think is one of the phenomena of our time. Where else in the world will you have several hundred million people being brought up on the same book and feeling that all of the truth that man can know is in this little red book that they wave? You've seen pictures of thousands of Chinese, especially Chinese youth, but not only youth, and all of them waving Mao's little red book. It's more than a Bible. There's no country in the world where everybody agrees on the Bible, certainly not even in America. But in China, at least outwardly, everyone agrees that this is the book that tells us about our nation and our place in the world and how to think and how to live. It isn't a very large book. You can read through it in a day, and it'll take you a long time to think through it. And it's only a part of his writings. The collected writings of Mao, you get four or five volumes, but here in this little abridgment you have the digest of his thought that the Chinese people are brought up on. It's the textbook of a nation. And in it, Mao has described what he wants the Chinese communist revolution to be. It has even greater significance because it introduces us to the thought of communism. And there isn't one American out of 10 that can give you an intelligent exposition of what communism is. Everybody agrees communism is atheism. And since I'm a Christian, communism is atheistic, I want to have nothing to do with it. Well, how much do you learn then about what communism is? Are you sure that what you're saying is true? Or do you know what you're fighting against? One of the things I find running through the thoughts of Mao is you should know your enemy. And here you have the strange situation that the communist is willing to know his enemy, Christianity and the Christian nations and the capitalistic world, whereas the Christian, who is supposed to love all men and be interested in all of God's creation and who talks about loving all of his neighbors, says, I hate the rest of the world that's communism. And I'm a good Christian because I hate communism. That's the way a good many of the Lutherans that I've met size up their attitude toward China. Here's a man, Here's a nation that is not Christian. I'm Christian. I don't want to be contaminated by it. Well, I can't quite feel that that's the way to handle the situation or to approach what is true in the world. Even error has its sides of truth. I used to have an old teacher years ago who said every error is a perverted truth. So that even as far as communism goes, it's interesting to find out what is the truth that is perverted here, because it must have some relationship to the truth. And you'll be surprised when you get into communistic philosophy what the perversion is. And it makes you be a little more critical in your own appraisal of what you are as a religious being. We take our Christianity altogether too easily. We like to take it in ready doses, all made up for us. And that isn't the kind of a world we're in. Well, let's see what Mao has to say on the things that had to do with China, but also with the rest of the world. I'm quoting here from some of his other writings as well as the Red Book, but I'll get down to that in just a moment. In a report on an investigation of the Hunan peasant movement way back in 1928, Mao defends the Peasants Association against charge of going too far. One of the things we used to hear a great deal in the newspapers, even though the people who wrote these things never been in China, I don't feel so bad about speaking about China, though I haven't been there, after I noticed that 10 out of every 12 American columnists or reporters who write on China have never been there either. And some of them haven't read too much on China. And one of the things that our newspapers was full of one while was the millions of Chinese who were being slaughtered by the communists. And there was truth to it, but that's about all that some of us knew about the Chinese. This is what Mao says about a revolution. A revolution is not the same as inviting people to dinner, or writing an essay, or painting a picture, or doing fancy needlework. It cannot be anything so refined, so gentle, or so mild, kind, courteous, restrained, and magnanimous. These are all confusion virtues, by the way. So what Mao is saying is, you can't judge a revolution by what Confucius taught was to be the right thing. A revolution is an uprising, an act of violence whereby one class overthrows another. If the peasants do not use the maximum of their strength, they can never overthrow the authority of the landlords, which has been so deeply rooted for thousands of years. He's defending, of course, the violence of the revolution. And we forget that every revolution is bloody. The American Revolution was no exception. We read the story of the American Revolution through rosy glasses, but there was carnage, there was bloodshed, there was injustice, where thousands of good Americans had to flee to Canada even then because of their opinions. I think one of the most ironic situations in America is the Daughters of the American Revolution. We're against all revolution except the first revolution. And they pride themselves over the fact. They'd never be a daughter of the revolution if they really had been against all revolution. So there is some truth in what Mao says here, that every revolution has violence because, and in this case, one class overthrows the other. The Americans overthrew the Tories, overthrew the British. The French Revolution, the one class overthrew the other class. In The American Civil War, one part of the country was trying to force itself on the other part. And remember, one of the bloodiest wars in all of history was the American Civil War. So you can't quite judge the Communist Revolution by a different standard than we should judge our own. But Mao's saying that the landlord class in China, which owned practically all of the land and forced 95% of the people, hundreds of millions of people, into servitude, there was no other way of doing this than by violence. I'm not defending it. I'm simply telling you what Mao says about it. And I'm hoping I am objective enough so that I'm trying to portray what led him and his people to do what they did. A man in China, he says, is usually subjected to the domination of three systems of authority. One, the system of the state. Two, the system of the clan. And in China, the family and the clan has a much greater hold on people than anything we in America recognize. Three, the system of gods and spirits. And he means here, of course, the place of religion in holding people in their place. These three dominations every Chinese feels. Women, further, he says, dominated by the authority of the husband. And these dominations of the clan, of gods and spirits, of domestic life, would be abolished as a natural consequence of victory in political and economic struggle. If you can eliminate the power of the state over all of its people, the kind of a state that China knew in the dynasties, then you'll get a freedom in these other realms as well. In an essay in 1940, and of course this is in the early stages, Mao writes, "The first stage is to end with the establishment of a new democratic society under the joint dictatorship of all Chinese revolutionary classes headed by the Chinese proletariat. Then the revolution will develop into the second stage, so that a socialist society can be established in China." You can't jump into communism all of a sudden. You have to go through stages. And this is true both of the Russian and the Chinese communists, the theory that goes back to Marx and Lenin, that democracy is just the first stage. And then through democracy, you can go on to a second stage, which will be socialism. And then through socialism, you'll go on to the top stage, which will be communism. So that we're not talking here about the same thing all of the time. There's a difference between socialism and communism. And I find that many Americans fear the word socialism as much as they fear the word communism, because they sense that socialism may be a step toward communism. If they see red when they hear communism, they turn pink when they hear socialism. We're afraid of these things, and we're afraid to face them, which I think is a form of cowardice myself. But we're afraid to face what we don't like. And the worst thing you can say about some things in America today is that we're on the road to socialism. Well, just what does that mean? I think we should be a little more clear. Khrushchev, you remember, was over here and said that socialism will bury capitalism, which didn't make him any more popular with Americans, certainly. But his thought was that we'll go on from the stage of democracy to socialism and then go on to communism. The interesting thing is it's on this very point that the Chinese and the Russians can't agree. The Chinese say that the Russians aren't communistic. They're socialistic, and they're going back into capitalism. So that The only true communists today, the Chinese say, are ourselves. We're against what is called revisionism. We don't want the communism revised. And there's a great battle between the Orthodox and the revisionists among the communists. We must separate, Mao says, all the rotten things of the ancient feudal ruling class from the fine ancient popular culture that is more or less democratic and revolutionary in character. There's a sort of a myth here that long before feudalism arose, with the domination of one class over other classes, there was a sort of a popular life where people lived a better life, where there was more equality, and where there was a golden age of humanity, a myth that runs through all of European history, the idea of a golden age back there somewhere. You had it in Greece, you had it in the thought that we have come down from something better and we'll have to get back to it. And so even in the communist, there is something of this nostalgia for a more perfect order of society, sort of a Thoreau idea of nature where men live more naturally, and we'll have to overthrow the kind of a government that has taken that away from us. Democracy among the people and dictatorship over the reactionaries combined to form the people's democratic dictatorship. There's a lot of inconsistency, I think we would say, about this. For while you're talking about democracy, you're always assuming, and we'll see this in more detail, that there's going to be a dictatorship somewhere that's going to bring in this democracy or this socialism. If it were true what the communists said, that these things are natural, they come by themselves, you wouldn't have to have a dictatorship of the proletariat, which simply means that the common people set up a dictatorship, and that the dictatorship then determines the whole form of society. Just what that dictatorship involves, we're also told as we go on. Well, let's get over to Chairman Mao's book. And these are quotations taken from Chairman Mao Zedong's book, translated, I'm using a publication by Stuart Schramm in 1968. A well-disciplined party, armed with the theory of Marxism-Leninism, using the methods of self-criticism, and linked with the masses of the people, an army under the leadership of such a party, a united front of all revolutionary classes and all revolutionaries under the leadership of such a party, these are the three main weapons with which we have defeated the enemy. This he wrote in 1949, the year that they won over the Kuomintang or Chiang Kai-shek. And he says, in these three ways, we defeated this whole array of forces against us. Remember, Chiang Kai-shek had millions and millions of dollars of help from the United States. We were hoping that Chiang Kai-shek would win over Mao. But Mao says these three things helped us to win the victory. We had a united front of all the revolutionaries in the country. We had a party that gave direction and self-criticism to the way things were to go. And we had the theory of Marxism and Leninism, together with an army. And here again, this is a note that comes in right along. You're working for the masses. It's supposed to be the masses that you represent. You have a theory that the masses are oppressed. They have to overthrow the group that controls them, the landlords, the leaders of industry, the politicians of the state. We've got to get rid of all of them. in the name of the masses. And we do it because we have the army. The army is the means by which we're able to overthrow our masters and allow the masses now to set up a new form of government. Whoever sides with the revolutionary people is a revolutionary. Whoever sides with imperialism, feudalism, and bureaucrat capitalism is a counter-revolutionary. I think a very helpful definition. The revolutionary will work with any other revolutionary. Don't have to agree on all theory, but those who are with us, we'll work with them at least for the time being. But against these revolutionaries are the imperialist, the feudalist, and the capitalist. Now, the imperialist is, of course, the one who believes in empire. And this is a word you'll find all over communist literature. And, of course, they blame the United States for being the main exponent of imperialism. Imperialism is the attempt of one great country to impose its will upon another. Because you're strong, you're going to make the weak country do your will. The Chinese looked on our intervention in Vietnam as imperialism. A great country, because it had the power, it was going to force a small country to do its will. And to the Chinese and to the Russian, imperialist is that part of the world which, because it has power, thinks it can superimpose its control over weaker powers. Feudalism refers to the history of China itself, where in a feudal system you have a few landowners who have the money, the land, the power, and then you have the masses of people who are slaves under them. And bureaucratic capitalism means the class that holds office, and because it holds office, thinks it's rather important. And this is of peculiar importance here because a little later, in the 1960s, we have another revolution, the Cultural Revolution in Russia, whereby the older communist system under Mao is afraid that the new office holders are becoming capitalistic minded. And so this counter-revolution of 1966 to 69 within the party is an attempt of the grassroots, we might say, communists to overthrow the bureaucrat who's on the way of becoming an elite class, and he has to be brought down to the level of the rest of the people. But anyone who is with us is against then these three foes that we have. There are still remnants of the overthrown landlord and comprador, or trading classes. There is still a bourgeoisie, and the remolding of the party bourgeoisie has only just started. The question of which will win out, socialism or capitalism, is still not really settled. This he wrote in 1951. The Little Red Book is a collection of quotations from other writings, so that these quotations come from different periods. But here in 1951, Mao says, we still don't know which is going to win out, but we do know what we are trying to do. The socialist system will eventually replace the capitalist system. This is an objective law independent of man's will. And that, of course, is one of the fundamental things of Marxism, that when you're talking about the decline of capitalism, the growth of socialism, and eventually the coming of communism, it isn't because people want it that way, or people fight for it even. It's because it's a law of nature. There is here an inherent faith of the communist in an objective way in which the world develops, and the political systems aren't entirely dependent on men. They depend on nature and the development of races and nations, and they have this faith that it isn't because we are bringing in this new system only, but because we're simply instruments in the destiny that works out this way. Again, you see, a dependence on something that is a faith, and we're dealing with the faith of a communist as over against the faith of a Christian. And each of them refers to an objective truth outside of itself. But the communist says, communism is simply the way that things develop objectively. And that, I think, was what Khrushchev meant. He says, you can fight against socialism, but it'll come because it's the way nations develop. The two stages, the democratic and the socialist revolutions, and the socialist revolution is the inevitable sequel to the democratic revolution. This goes back to 1939. The changeover from individual to socialist, collective ownership in agriculture and handicrafts, and from capitalist to socialist ownership in private industry and commerce is bound to bring about a tremendous liberation of the productive forces. Once this change has occurred from democracy to socialism, there will be a great increase in the way men live and work, produce, and we'll have a better world just because the system itself has changed. Although there are over 10 million members in our party, they still constitute a very small minority of the country's population. This Mao wrote in 1956, which was well into the period when they were in control. He says there are 10 million of us, and yet that's a small amount. 10 million over against 800 million? What percentage would that be? Very small, but is it not? But it shows you that 10 million people concentrated on what they want to do and united in their effort are able to control 800 million people. It takes only a minority, and this is less than a minority. And the same thing is true, of course, in Russia. The Communist Party in Russia is, I don't recall the figures now, but certainly less than 5% of the Russian population. So that the facts that we face in this modern world is that small groups which have power control great nations of population far beyond their numbers. It makes you wonder where the power really lies. We'll find out what the communists think, where they think it lies. But it also reflects back on our Christian faith that you need only a small group that will affect a large number of people. And that, of course, is true in European history. The number of Christians through the centuries has never been large. So I'm speaking now of conscious Christians, as apart from those simply born into the church in the Middle Ages, but the Roman Catholic Church, and later even in the state churches of the Reformation, a small group could dominate the whole group. And numbers isn't the criterion always for decision. Our people's government is one that genuinely represents the people's interests. It is a government that serves the people. One can't help but recall an American phrase, Lincoln's, government of the people, by the people, for the people. And I'm not so sure, but some of the thought of American Revolution and American philosophy isn't back even of much of communism in our own time. Certainly the emphasis on the masses, on the people, and that what we want is a government of the people. For ages you had it taken for granted that a small group of people above governed the whole country. In the kingdoms of Europe, the monarchy was taken for granted. They ruled the country. The emperor decides. In Rome, emperor's will, the Senate ruled. You've taken for granted that there is a ruling class, and that is in the background, I think, of all modern history. Here comes this new thought that there should be the will of the people expressed, and somehow the will of the people finds instruments of expression and of control, and the communists claim, we represent the masses. Though we're only 10 million, we represent 800 million. We are the voice of the people, and we determine what the people shall do. Every communist, and this I think is a revealing statement that is quoted quite often, but it's so candid that it deserves emphasis. Every communist, Mao says, must grasp the truth. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. The man that holds the gun has the power. And the communist is frank to say, we have the army, we have the gun, we have the power. Who has the army determines what the people will be. And that's been true all through history. And that makes some Americans a little afraid that it might even become true here, that the Pentagon, which has the gun, tells the rest of the country what to do. We're dealing with conditions that are alike in all countries. And the pride and boast of our democracy has been that the army, the military, is under civilian control in America. But once Eisenhower himself was clear enough to foresee that the power of the military and the power of the people who serve the military and who grow rich on the military can become stronger than the civil administration. But the communist says clearly, we intend to have the power of the military, and as long as we do, we can control our nation. According to the Marxist theory of the state, the army is the chief component of state power. Only with guns can the whole world be transformed. Mao wrote this in 1938, even before he came to power. The east wind, and here's another quotation to find occasionally, the east wind is prevailing over the west wind. This expression of the hope of the communists that the east, with its philosophy in Russia and China, will prevail over the west. The First World War, he says, was followed by the birth of the Soviet Union with a population of 200 million. The Second World War was followed by the emergence of the socialist camp with a combined population of 900 million. It's interesting that the communists admit that communism has grown through wars. And they say that the imperialists will destroy themselves. It's after the First World War, after the Second World War, that socialism triumphed. Then he goes on to say, if the imperialists insist on launching a Third World War, it is likely that the whole structure of imperialism will utterly collapse. Let the imperialists go on, prepare their wars, kill each other, and then we'll have communism. That is a part of the communist faith. Without a people's army, he says the people have nothing. The Chinese Red Army is an armed body for carrying out the political tasks of the revolution. Some interesting events have taken place in our own time, and we can only refer to them fleeting. Mao has never relinquished command over the military. In the Constitution, which was written just a few years ago, and has just now been superimposed a week ago by the new Constitution at the 10th Congress, Lin Piao, L-I-N-P-I-A-O, was named as the successor of Mao. Lin Piao was in charge of the army, and he worked with Mao, and Mao looked upon him. Mao was now 80 years old, as the man to succeed him. And from what's now beginning to emerge, it seems that Lin Piao, using his power at the head of the army, began to plot against Zhou Enlai. And not so long ago, Lin Piao met his death in a very suspicious manner. There's a column in the Seattle paper yesterday or the day before. Can't be too sure how much knowledge the writer has, but one of the columnists claims that it's been discovered that Lin Piao had staged a coup d'etat. He was going to assassinate Zhou Enlai, who stood next to Mao in the minds of many in power. The plot failed, and Lin Piao and his family got into aeroplanes and were going to flee to Russia. Either they were shot down or they ran out of gas. They came down in Mongolia and were killed. Lin Piao, the designate successor of Mao, then was killed because within the party itself, the man that had control of the army thought that he could overthrow even Mao. I say many of these things we can only guess at, but it shows that within the party there is faction and strife, but that the man who controls ultimately the army wins out, and Mao and Zhou Enlai did have the army with them. Now we don't know who the successor of Mao will be. It's supposed that Zhou Enlai will be. He's about 75, so even he wouldn't be happy around many years, and someone else will have to take his place. The Chinese Red Army is an armed body for carrying out the political tasks of the revolution. Take the ideas of the masses and concentrate them. Then go to the masses, persevere in the ideas, and carry them through so as to form correct ideas of leadership. Such is the basic method of leadership. Mao defines here how you become a leader. You go to the masses, the people, find out what really are the deep fundamental ideas and wants of the people. Then you concentrate, you refine them, you form a philosophy as to what the masses want, and then you find the ways in which to carry through these ideas with great perseverance, and ultimately you'll succeed. This is the way then the masses speak. To many of us, it would seem to be an inconsistency that you have to have a little well-disciplined group at the top that speaks for hundreds of millions of people. And the proletariat, which in both Russia and China is the proletarian means the masses here, The dictatorship of the people has to be expressed through a few top people. You certainly can argue, how are you sure that these people represent what the mass is? And when the masses themselves begin to question whether the leadership is expressing, as they've done in communism, how true is it that the top leadership, that the dictatorship, is able to represent the people? It seems as if Marxism was once all the rage, and this Mao writes in 1957, but is currently not so much in fashion. To counter these tendencies, we must strengthen our ideological and political work. Both students and intellectuals should study hard. Not to have a correct political point of view is like having no soul. And the correct political view is to the Chinese to follow the thoughts of Mao. Mao says our duty is to hold ourselves responsible to the people. Every word, every act, and every policy must conform to the people's interests. Time is running on. One place Mao says that our God is none other than the masses of the Chinese people. It's the masses that is our God. And we try to find out what they are, what they need, what they want, and we carry it through. I know that you must have questions, so I'm going to stop here for a few minutes. We can take up some of these things. I'm only halfway through what I'd hoped to bring on from the quotations, but probably you've got enough to sense what Mao is about and what he wants. Are there questions that you want to ask?
One slight parallel to the Little Red Book and the Bible is that it has an almost built-in ambiguity sometimes. You and I, after my vespers of the night, talked the following day just for 1 second, whereby I said the animals in Africa are in danger largely because the Africans are starving, and the dilemma of human values versus the animal values. Mao's book has this two eyes that look several different directions, so there's just not one interpretation to be drawn from any one of his sharp maxims.
No.
In other words, you can argue fighting the capitalist, you can argue getting along with President Nixon from almost the same aphorism.
Yes, these writings of Mao are sharp in definitions, and I suppose one reason for the emphasis on everybody in China studying them is to try to agree on some definition, some understanding of them. It's hard for us to realize that in every school in Russia, they take certain time every day to study Mao's Red Book. In every factory in Russia, on every farm in Russia, you have to have certain hours every week when you get together and study Mao's thoughts. Every Chinese is supposed to know what is taught by this Chairman Mao. And with these hundreds of millions of people, all different kinds of backgrounds, of course you would have different attitudes. And the Cultural Revolution, which to me is one of the most significant happenings since communism came to power, evidently was an attempt of Mao to get around the development in China itself of interpretations of Mao's thoughts, which he thought were not revolutionary. He felt that the bureaucracy, the officers, the official people were becoming an elite again. And there was one leader, Liu, L-I-U, Liu Cha, who got all the blame in the Cultural Revolution. And he was charged with wanting to go back to capitalism. There is in China, and there has been from the time of the Chinese Revolution in 1912, a group in China, and especially intellectuals, who have said we've got to learn Western ways. We've got to be able to meet the West on technological basis. We've got to have scientists. We've got to study what the West studies so that we can have the improvements and the inventions and the instruments that the West has. Mao is against any Westernization in China. And he thinks that with the vast manpower in China, if they can all be welded together into one, they don't have to depend on the West. That in itself, he hasn't succeeded because we're told that the Chinese now are developing the atomic bomb. They've had to yield to that extent that they're trying to meet the West in the military things. I'd hope to get into a little more detail on this point, and I'll have to just summarize it, that you find that Mao really believes that he can change the character of the Russian people, of the Chinese people, so that instead of the individual working for himself, looking out for himself, that the Chinese thinks only of helping the state and of helping the people as a whole. They use the phrase that you're against individualism. And I suppose this is the point at which you would find the communist and our American philosophy the most direct conflict. We are individualists. Some people wonder if we're not going pretty far in that direction. The Chinese is collectivist. You live for the state, you live for the people, and you have to live in a way to your neighbor that will make for a good social order. You don't do it through the developing the individuality of a person. That destroys some of this unity. You do it through working out a system of correct behavior. And the word correct comes in everywhere in communist literature. There's a correct way of life, a correct way of meeting your neighbors, even the idea of punishment. We're told that there aren't too many people in jail in China. For the minor crimes especially, you don't take a man to court or to jail. You bring him before the party or before a group of communists and get him to confess his fault. And by example and by persuasion, you try to change him. And even the higher crimes, they say that punishment doesn't do it. There's a idea of the correction of the deviant in society that's almost startling. We're beginning to wonder if we're treating criminals right, if we aren't making more criminals in our jails and correcting them. China has the idea you can bring popular opinion to bear in the community on the individual so that he will not be doing the unsocial thing. It's fascinating, the very idea that they have, that Mao thinks he can change the character of a whole people. It's a daring thing, and there are those who wonder if what we say is human nature in the long run won't prevail. What is human nature? All of this thing bristles with questions for the Christian, and I wish the Christian church would take a little more seriously than it does this confrontation with another philosophy of life that we don't understand. Any other questions?
It is a utopia.
Does Mao go along with this, that his whole
hardly need any government except just to keep order, but that the people will be so socialized that they'll think of society and the good of society to the point where it will be a utopia.
I'm glad you mentioned this. Tomorrow, I'm going to take our time to review a couple of articles of men who come back from China. In the Rotarian of April, there's a very fine article by Seymour Topping, managing editor of the New York Times, who was in China before the revolution, and now he's been back, and he tells us what he sees. In the Worldview for January 73, a professor of Princeton has an article after the Cultural Revolution. And I'm going to read sections of what these men saw in China, exactly on the things that you're talking about. How far have they succeeded? So that you don't feel you're taking my word for these things, but here are observers who tell us. And the thing that surprised me is that you have all kinds of journalists going to China, and they come back with about the same story. There are some cynics among them, yes, but you've got to admit that they saw things that are different from the old China. Now, I know that the first reaction is, what did they see? There are parts of China they never saw. That may be. But at least let's take things what they did see. And secondly, I don't see that there's any doubt about the fact that Mao thought that he was bringing about a new kind of society in which he claims that he's a Marxist, a good Marxist. He claims that the Russians are not good Marxists. They're revisionists. They are becoming imperialists. You wonder how much does he feel this way because the Russian army's on the north. But theoretically, he claims that they have departed from Marxism-Leninism and that the Chinese are the true communists because they still believe that the ultimate is a classless society. For the Marxist believes that if you can win the class struggle, defeat the imperialists and the bureaucracy, and bring in socialism, the next step will be a communistic society where you don't need government. They say that the dictatorship of the proletariat will fade away. And because men live together for each other and are concerned about a good life here on earth, you don't need a government to enforce some other kind of power upon them. It is a dream. It is another form of utopia. And many of the Chinese themselves don't believe it, or they wouldn't be contending against him. But you're dealing here with a man who is 80 years old, and who since 49, that's 25 years ago, has imposed his will and his ideas on the whole people, and who before that overthrew one of the great empires of history. Tell me where there's anything more fascinating happening in the world today. Well, if you stay with us, we'll go on tomorrow.